Accession number 19855, reel 4.
Jimmy Lisa, reel 4.
And it meant that officers would have to do almost constant patrols. You'd come back, you'd look at, see any letters, any paperwork you had to do in your foxhole or some unlikely place to write anything. If other members of the platoon had written letters, you had to read them and censor them. They were marked usually at the back, H-O-L-L-A-N-D, Holland, hoping our love lasts and never dies. Or Italy, I trust and love you. Dear Joan, there's not much happened here. Bit hot. Hope all is well with you and the cat's okay. And that was the, wasn't much to censor in these things. But it was a considerable strain after a day of doing this and washing your clothes. I was very lucky as an officer. I had the services of a batman who could help do this for me. One had to set off again on some wretched patrol without much enthusiasm. And I remember the heat and the humidity was such that some of the older members, I mean older, only in their 30s, because the rest of us were pretty young, they had what was called heat stroke, which I think really was a small stroke or a heart attack. I remember in one case, a poor fellow, he just collapsed, and we carried him under some bushes in what shade there was. Rest formed a ring round the guard, and he just couldn't go on at all, and equally he couldn't go back. And we said it was heat stroke, but as I say, I think it was a stroke or heart attack. And he had a good friend in the platoon, so he left the friend with him with two rifles and so many rounds each. But we took all the kit, which neither of them, the friend he used with this poor fellow, they couldn't carry his kit, he couldn't carry the ill man's kit, so we had to share that out among us, so on our backs. And luckily they got back safely to base. He rested till dusk and then set off on his way again. But because of the fear that patrols were not going to the full extent of their distance, we had maps, very rudimentary things, just marked in some cases, just jungle, impenetrable, because no surveyor had ever been through them. And there were various marked points with numbers on them, map references. And we were told that our aim was to go to such and such a map reference, for example. And every so many hours, we had to radio back where we were with the map reference, and presumably there was some means of checking if we were actually where we said we were, you see. Now, the radio in those days was called a 38 set, which was like a small suitcase and was on the back of usually the strongest man, who had to carry all his kit as well. And the aerial was in the form of a series of hollow copper tubes which fitted one in the other, so it stuck up like a car radio aerial today. And on the back of this set, the operator stood behind the set, and there were four sides open on wooden metal rods with canvas around them, which could give him some sort of shield from the light, so he could see two dials, which presumably were the tuning things, and he'd tune in at such and such an hour every day. He had earphones. And if you could get through, which was problematical because the jungle blanketed the signals, and the set was so old, I think it was designed in 1929 and might have worked on Salisbury Plain, but with interference in the jungle it was very poor. These huge dry batteries which had to be carried. We'd say where we were and get an acknowledgement and then go on. Now, after a time, some of these patrols, it was clear that the Japanese knew where they were and were waiting for us. And there were sort of jungle tracks which one had to follow through. I mean, it wasn't impenetrable jungle. It was like a thick wood in many cases, but there were sort of animals' tracks and open spaces. And some of the regiments out there, they followed these tracks. Now, it seemed to me that if you're following a track, it's a very easy thing to have an ambush, to have a string or a wire tied across the track, which you don't see because you're tired and you're sweating and the heat and the light in the eyes, and you trip on Saturday train, you can be ambushed. And I made our people, my people, on the areas which one felt there could be an ambush, to go around the side to one side, which was very unpopular, but at least another regiment I knew out there, they followed them slavishly, these tracks, and they had ambush after ambush, because it might be more comfortable, but it was a lot less safe. But we noticed that the Japanese seemed to have forewarning of our arrival, and sort of skirmishes took place. Luckily, no injuries on our side. And when we came back after one of these, there was a whole, what they call an orders group, I think, where all the officers were called together, the whole battalion. One never met them normally, never saw them, because we were spread out, one company here, another company farther off, and so on. And the CO wanted to know what anyone thought, and how the Japanese could know where we were. And no one had any idea, and I, coming back from these radio patrol things with them vividly in my mind, I said, "Oh, I could speak, sir." "Yes." Well, I say, we report back our position every hour, giving the map reference. It's possible the Japanese have captured some of our maps and exactly where we are. And Seo looked at me in a very hostile way. He said, "You speak Japanese?" I said, "No, sir." Well, he said, "How do you suppose the Japanese know English then?" Well, I said, "It's a more common language." And everyone roared with laughter on this. But that was quite true, what was happening. And this gave you, suddenly for the first time, I began to have doubts about the efficiency of some of the chain of command. And I think I wasn't the only one. And I remember once we came back from a patrol and we came through a little clearing in the so-called jungle. It really wasn't a very thick jungle, about the size of a tennis court or something. And we're going through here, and suddenly there's a rustling in the bushes, and we all raise our weapons, and there's a hog or a wild boar, a sow, with all its young, and they charge around, you see, and they charge at us. Now, we can't fire because we think the Japanese are there, so we shout, "F off, F off," this sort of thing, at them. And finally, we chuck stones or anything at them, and they do. But it was very lucky that we weren't done to death by boars. I mean, B-O-A-R-S, not B-O-R-E-S. Going back to my time at Belgaum, I said the course was not very demanding. And in fact, I had so much time off, we didn't work in the afternoons. We could either sleep or I don't know how we spent our time. But I started writing a novel. And I wrote this and sent it home with what were called airgraphs in those days. You wrote a page, you wrote on a page of heat-sensitive, light-sensitive paper. You put it in an envelope and posted it without a stamp to some address in India. It was then photographed down to the size of a micro dot, dispatched to England, enlarged up to the original size, and posted to a recipient. And I wrote a novel called Not Such a Bad Day about a coach load, a shadowbang load of people who go to a North Country seaside resort, as I knew well, Southport in Lancashire, and how this one day affects all their lives. Not probably a very original idea, but it struck me as being original. And this taught me one thing. I couldn't keep a copy of what I wrote. There had no carbon paper or anything like that. And if I'd asked for it, it would be viewed with suspicion. So I had to remember in my head what I'd said in each thing. And I therefore wrote this thing page by page, about, must have been about 400 pages of it, and could, like someone learning a part of a play, knew the thing virtually word for word. And my mother, who was a remarkable person, she got it typed somehow and saw an advert in a paper for a literary agent who wanted manuscript, sent it to this man who said he wanted £7.10, £7.50 to read it, which nowadays he wouldn't have got. And he took it on, and on 10% he sold it. It was published in 1946. After the war, it sold, I think, 28,000 copies, only as a paperback. But it was a great fillip to me when I heard, in Burma by then, that this thing had been sold. And the times went on, and two things happened which I remember very well. One Saturday or Friday, we were told the whole battalion was the whole platoon was to move to a different role. We were on the edge of the jungle, facing a very large flat plateau. When I say very large, I mean several miles across. In the centre of this plateau was, or plain, there was what was known as a tank, which was a big reservoir dug for water to irrigate the paddy fields, which this plain had been before the war. There were a few huts and a lot of trees which gave shelter. And another platoon was in this indefensible position, had been there for a week, and it was our job to go out there for the next week. Well, we were given a Bren gun carrier, which was a very curious piece of armoured mechanism, like a very small tank with tracks, and it was just a hollow metal box. In this box, there was the driver who stood, I think, at a wheel, a vertical wheel, or maybe he had a seat. And there was another man who had a Bren gun, which shot the same calibre bullets as a .303 rifle. And there was a space and a Ford V8 engine in the middle. And this thing was a ludicrous vehicle. It could carry its own weight. But if it passed anyone of hostile intent, they only had to lob a grenade into this open, unroofed centre, and the thing was finished. I don't know why it was ever built or what purpose it was meant to serve, but in this case it served our purpose. We could dump our bedding rolls, which was a mosquito net or a strip of mosquito net and a blanket and a ground sheet, and the rest, such kits we had, we carried, and we took over from this other platoon. We were very glad to get out of it, and we dug ourselves in. And there was one defensive position which was a weapon pit with a roof of some sort over it and logs and tree trunks, and you peered through between a slit through the roof, the tree trunks on the ground, only faced one way. And if the enemy decided to come the other way, you just had other people in the platoon who had to lie on the ground and try and ward them off. And we had some chickens, live chickens in wicker baskets, which were part of our rations. And we were there Saturday morning, and it was a pretty odd place because there was a nasty atmosphere about it. There had been some massacre had taken place there of someone, I'm not sure who, and it was a very evil atmosphere. And as we sort of went about our business, loosed the chickens, let them out of the cages, they get some water and peck something to eat, we could see people across the plateau in the other side of the jungle from where we had come moving about. And it was obvious they must be Japanese. And we had a radio, and we managed to get through to say they're Japanese on that side. Are we to engage them or what? And the message came back, I think it was, you know, wait until attacked. So we, in any case, you couldn't do anything but wait. And on the Saturday afternoon, suddenly I was in this odd defensive place. I saw two men in British uniforms walking casually across the plateau, or so they just on a Saturday afternoon stroll. And one of them was an artillery spotter, and the second one was his radio operator. And they had said vaguely they'd heard that someone was in command of this place, and they were going to come out and spot any enemy they saw so they could ask for artillery fire to be put down on them. And we pointed out these people walking out in the woods. A rather uneasy sense fell upon the whole platoon because it was clear there were very many more of them than us. And we had all our weapons loaded and weighted, had a meal of some sort. And then the notice came through, you're to stand and hold this at whatever cost, not till the last round of the last man, but that's what it meant. And so this, again, didn't raise our spirits in any marked degree. And this fellow couldn't get through on his radio. It was not surprisingly, it's a similar one as we had to his command. So he'd come all this way at enormous risk, just two people walking casually through the Bundu, for no purpose whatever. And then gradually there was air grew even more sinister, so we heard a barking noise like a gun, and it was a mortar. And they're firing from where we saw the Japanese. And they were firing what they call bracketing. They couldn't get the range exactly, so they fired some to one side and some to the other. And they were too far away for us to fire with our Bren guns or rifles. We just had to wait the hell we were. So everyone took what cover he could. And again, I had the feeling that this must be the end. I mean, there's no way we can get out of this. And yet, just sit here, we're not doing anything, it's so bloody ridiculous. And I happened to have, I carried always a little Bible. I bought part of a Bible in Chittagong. It was the only thing I could, only bit I could find in a stall, about half chapters of Leviticus or something. And I just turned it open, and there was a phrase there that said, verily I say unto you, there are some here who will not taste of death. And I thought, that's a message. I said, we're going to get out of this. But how? And by now, the bloody things were falling left and right, and we could hardly see out of our hole. At that moment, the radio came on. The old, this artillery chap's radio, he left it on. And he said, orders, you know, retreat back to so-and-so. So I said, come on, we're off. And we got out. And as we got out, the Japanese moved out from their place. And we fired everything we could at them, with what result, I don't know. And before we left, we rather cruelly, again I remembered this, tied grenades down to the chickens' legs and in the chickens' baskets, and so that when they rooted among there for food, they'd blow up and would do them a mischief. And we set off, and there was so much firing and this and that that we doubted we'd ever just cross this open space. And then a tank, of all things, came by, a Sherman tank, and it had written on the side, New Cross, which was quite near where Erith was, New Cross and Elephant and Castle. So we're in the home, and this thing turned around, and we all crowded in behind it, and we sort of, with it between us and where the firing was, we got to where the Japanese, where the position was. We had only one man who was hurt with a shrapnel in his arm, I think. And then we were told to fall in and follow where the battalion had gone, marching. Because of the army stores, like our ground sheets and blankets are still down there, a senior officer dispatched a Bren gun carrier back to the place, so it should be loaded up. So a driver and some other fellow loaded these things, I would think, with some considerable speed, and they came after us. And we were going across this Bundu, and we came to a sort of tongue of land that stuck out from the forest or jungle on one side. And we had to pass this thing, and the Japanese kept shelling on that point. And my little lot, I said, we wait till there's a shell, and then we run, and we get through before they can load and do it again, you see. Otherwise, you know, we straggle through there, we're not going to do it. And one fellow, young fellow, I suppose older than me, he sort of lost his nerve and started to run. And I ran after him to grab him, and at that moment the shell landed, and we were both blown up. And he was all right somewhere, and I was put out my back so that I couldn't walk. I just got no sensation from down the middle of my spine. And all the rest of the platoon got off and cleared off. And I remember crawling like a sort of wounded worm on my elbows forward to follow them, you see, because I want to be left out there. The Japanese would bayonet any wounded person. He wouldn't have a minute's chance. And crashing as I moved, I got some feeling back in my legs and began to sort of shamble about. And I got to where I finally found the platoon and joined them on, and we got to some sort of rendezvous point. And there's not much could be done because there's nothing to show except this terrible pain in the back and so on, which had dislocated it in some way. And gradually it got better, but not quite right. In fact, it has never been right since. But it got livable with, and we went on to more patrols and so on. But after a time, more and more of us got ill with these not one yet diagnosed fevers or malaria. Because so we carried with us a strip of mosquito net to wrap around our face so we slept at night in the open air, and we put some anti-mosquito cream on our wrists and things where you got bitten. It was still very difficult because they came at the edges of your eyes, so the cream stung so much we didn't put it on. But some other regiment, I remember they had their mosquito nets, which are quite big nets, the size of a single bed, which you could tie to trees. And they, on a patrol, they tied their nets up like that and went to sleep under them. And the Japanese found them and just bayoneted them as they lay in the nets, you see, which was a nasty hazard. Anyhow, I'm removed to some sort of casualty clearing station with these, my back and the malaria and the fevers, which take time to cure. And again, being keen on writing, I wrote a short story for a Forces magazine, which was published by the Public Relations Directorate in New Delhi, GHQ there, a weekly magazine, I think, called Victory, like Lilliput in those days. And they published this thing and sent me 20 rupees for something I was very pleased to have. Now, I've been now in Burma for quite a long time, about 10 months. And with this back, it's pretty obvious that I'm not in very good shape. And I have a medical board, and I was A1 when I joined the army, and now I'm put down to C2. Now, the worst is C3, and you'd be thrown out. Luckily, I'm not that. Now, I'm told to go back to Chittagong or somewhere, and then onward dispatch. And I'm sent back to Doolally, the old British base reinforcement camp. Now, I realize I'm a full lieutenant now. You were given promotion after 6 months. But there's no future back in India. The job you would get is in movement control or something, which is appalling, because I'm not very methodical. And you get sort of 1,000 troops arriving at Gaya Junction at 4 in the morning. You've got to find food, trucks for them, put them up for a night, and get them on. Well, this I couldn't do. I feel I could do any justice to that. And I find that the train goes through Delhi, so I just get off the train at Delhi, and I put up in a what was called then a bazaar hotel, an Indian hotel, in this new Delhi, which was designed by Lutyens, with wide avenues and thoroughfares, and circuses, Connaught Circus and so on, and the old Delhi, which is the old place for the Red Fort, for the Red Mutiny, Indian Mutiny. Was the focus of the Indian Mutiny. And I'm in some terrible hotel there, where I jam my revolver behind the door so it can't be opened at night. And the only Englishman there is obviously a very pro-Gandhi, pro-Congress, an unhealthy place to be. But the next day I get out, have a bath, shave, get a tonga. I couldn't afford a taxi. Again, money, you see, in Burma, you didn't get any because there's nothing to spend it on. And you had to go through such bureaucratic things to get your money. I mean, I'd have to find some unit in Delhi, then prove who I was and hang about and get some money, which I hadn't done. I had a few rupees. And I got to GHQ, where there was the directorate of the public relations place who published this novel, this magazine, which I had written the article for. And I thought I might get something there. And I have a curious thing which I've seen referred to in other people claiming credit for it. Whether it's true or not, it certainly was true for me. outside the KHQ. I said, I'd like to go in and see the public relations director. Have you got a pass? No. How can I get a pass? When you get inside. So you, in this fatuous thing. And I'm arguing the toss here. And some other officers come up and see me and say, what's wrong? And I said, I want to get in. They say, let him in. So I'm an Indian soldier, sepoy, lets me in. And I wander through this labyrinthine place in a vast building. And I find the director. I dump my kit somewhere, I don't know where now. I find the director and find the editor of this magazine, a chap called Rodney Hobson, who before the war had been a copywriter and had, for advertising, had composed the words for the song We Are the Ovaltines. And he was very successful at this business and then was called up. And of course, he was about in his 30s. And after the war, he found it very difficult to get back because he was the talented chap, but the war had come. He was very talented at the wrong time for him, his age, because after the war, they wanted people at 25. Anyhow, he'd nothing for me. I saw another man who was producing a twice-weekly paper called Contact for the Troop. He'd nothing for me. But I said I'd rather, elaborating my experience, said I'd been on newspapers and so on. And I'm given, told good luck and go on to Doolally. I'm stuck there. There's nothing to do at all. And I found a little, start a little paper called the BBRC Bugle, which really consisted of articles I could lift from English papers, which were set by some typesetter there. And by listening to the early morning broadcasts from Bombay, I suppose, we could find the football results and cricket results, whatever else, and print those, which was rare. And I came across something in Doolally which made a mark on my mind. This place was, the paper was printed by a private firm in a town called Nasik, N-A-S-I-K, which was a very Congress anti-British place. And the printing press was a primitive thing, flatbed, in the garden of a big house. And the Indian who ran it was a very pleasant man. And one day, I see a white woman walking down the garden. She's wearing a sari. And we get talking. And she's an American who married this man when he on a trip to America or something. And I had no idea the conditions she'd be coming back to. And of course, she'd no money and couldn't get out. And there she was, trapped in this place. I always thought it was an awful thing. And while I was in Doolally, there's some immense riot in Nasik, for some reason or other. And every officer in his sense and buggered off, got the hell out, because otherwise they're going to be sent on it. I didn't realize this. And was, I suppose, the only one that could be found. And I was told I was in charge of a group of maybe a platoon of men, and I got to go down in support of the civil power, the magistrate, who was an Indian, who was going to read the riot act and then the buggers would disperse. Well, I didn't know any of the men in this platoon, they didn't know me, and none of us had any enthusiasm for this thing. And I said, look, on no circumstances, fire, because we're going down there, there are going to be hundreds down there, only 20 of us or so. It's madness, that, just don't do it. If we have to fire, I'll give the order, and we'll fire in the air, which I think is illegal, but it's better than firing on the ground. Well, we get down to this place, and it's an unbelievable scene. There are a handful of policemen with lathes, you know, these long sticks, and one white officer in charge of them, and the magistrate is an Indian in his dhoti and so on, and he's on the back of a truck going to read the riot act through a loudhailer. And as far as you can...